Session number 12778.
From Martin Rail 3.
Right, the airborne troops had removed the charges, and they were in position on high ground overlooking the bridge, had been able to keep it under small arms fire, but the bridge was really in no man's land between the German troops, the other side, and ourselves. So the position was the remnants of the airborne troops were on the high ground just south of the bridge. The mobile column of 9 DLI had met up with them, and the rest of 9 DLI was still marching up towards the bridge. My 6th Platoon and Dupre went into position just south of the where the paratroops were for the night, and at midnight the remainder of 9 DLI arrived marching together with all the gun numbers of 6th Platoon, which was some 20 miles. It was a pretty good day's marching. At about 3 a.m. on the early morning of the 15th of July, the sounds of an enemy motorized column could be heard approaching the 9 DLI in the Primacelli Bridge area. And it was an enemy column which ran straight into the Northumberland Hussars anti-tank guns and our own machine guns. And we, on this occasion, did have 6th Platoon firing through battle sights at the enemy, who were clearly visible in the bright moonlight. Three tanks were knocked out, and in the morning the area was littered with enemy dead and wounded. In the meantime, the Brigadier had come up, and I was with him, and he made a plan for 9 DLI to attack the bridge at 7:30 a.m. on the 15th. It obviously hadn't been possible for the 9 DLI to do a night attack, as the Brigadier would have liked to have done, because having only arrived in at midnight at the neighbourhood of the bridge, not having seen the area, and absolutely whacked. I think it was a miraculous that they were in any fit state to put in an attack at 7:30 the next morning. But by 7:30, 6th Platoon were up on a ridge which not only dominated the bridge, a girder bridge about 400 foot long, but also because their range were able to fire straight up the main road leading down from Catania to the bridge, which ran between poplars, and also dominated the low ground on either side of the bridge, except immediately to the west of the bridge, which was all vineyards, and nobody could see what was inside there at all. But that was where the enemy clearly were, but one couldn't see a thing. So the attack went in, and 9 DLI managed to get some companies across the bridge, but in the vineyards they very soon lost control of where they were going. These vines were obstructing all views. The enemy were clearly very well dug in, and 9 DLI had to pull back across the bridge onto our own side again. What no one knew at this stage was that at the back of the vineyards was a sunken road, which was occupied by German paratroops, from which they could fire straight through the vineyards in front of them, and were practically immune from artillery fire from our own side. And this was to be a nasty shock in the days ahead. There was then some suggestion of putting in another attack in the early afternoon with 8 DNI, but that was abandoned, and it was decided that 8 DNI would put in an attack that night. Now, we had met up when we arrived at Plymouth Bridge with Lieutenant Colonel Alistair Pearson, a highly decorated and a splendid officer of the Parachute Regiment, who had commanded the force which had captured the bridge. And although he moved his own soldiers back as soon as we were up in position, he stayed up himself as an advisor to the Brigadier on what was the other side of the bridge. And he had in particular discovered that the river Somito was fordable about 400 yards west of the bridge. He had brought his own chaps back that way rather than across the bridge, and he volunteered to guide an attacking force down to the river and to the crossing point, and in particular to tape the with white tape the route down there. And so it was decided that there would be a night attack by the 8th DLI down through this ford across the river. They would then form up on the bank on the other side, swing right-handed and clear the vineyards along the moving from west to east, and then form up round the bridge in a bridgehead. Two companies, the other two companies would then come through them across the bridge, and the tanks would follow through these two companies, and we would debouch into the Catania plain and continue the advance. All that particular day we were firing at any enemy attempt to lay charges on the bridge, and we also were firing at reinforcements coming down the Catania road towards the bridgehead area, and that seemed to be pretty effective in preventing any enemy reinforcement of the area. Right, well, during the night of the 15th, 16th, the 8th DLI put in their attack. They crossed the river by the ford. They wheeled east towards the bridge, and we were able to support this attack from the ridge which we were on, overlooking the bridge area, by firing just in front of where they should be. We tied in our fire with the artillery fire plan, so that as the artillery lifted and moved as a creeping barrage across in front of the 8th July, we were moving our machine gun fire as well. And we fired for an hour and a quarter, and the attack was successful, and the 8th DLI were on the bridge. But and that's where things started to go wrong for them, and because all the means of communication for getting their two reserve companies up failed. I think there were the four methods. The radios had all been not sunk, but damaged by water going across the ford, which was between 3 and 6 foot deep. So the radios had been drowned. They couldn't call for their reserve companies by the radio. The signal pistols, the cartridges, had also got wet and wouldn't go off. The commanding officer had arranged for Royal Engineers to drive an armoured vehicle up to the bridge when it looked as if the 8th DLI had got onto their objectives, but he and his vehicle were hit by a shell, and so there was no radio contact there. And I think the day was saved by a War Office observer who'd been sent to watch the battle. who came trundling down to the bridge on his bicycle, and who was then rapidly sent forward to bring the reserve companies through. It's an extraordinary story, but we did have observers being sent out to watch battles. Usually they were troops from other divisions who hadn't yet been bloodied. I remember at Wadi Akrit, a whole collection of officers and NCOs from 56th were sent forward to watch the Wadi Akrit battle. And I remember saying to a company sergeant major of these 56th NCOs, "Well, how's everything going?" And he said, "I don't know, you're making bloody history, aren't you?" Anyhow, it was fairly normal for observers of some sort, and this chap saved the day, and the reserve companies got across. But they were in a very, very sticky position from these paratroops, who, it was now discovered, were in this sunken ditch at the back of the vineyards, and it was clearly going to require another attack to go through them, to get them out. Particularly as our own tanks were extremely worried about some 88 guns, which 88 millimetre guns, so it was supposed to be a two or three over the other side. They also said that the vineyards were impassable to tanks, although, as case proved the following day, they were anything but impassable. But anyhow, the plan now was for a further attack, and this was going to be done by the 6th DLI and 9th DLI. And this was to take place on the night of the 16th, 17th July. I was visited by my own commanding officer, Colonel Keeling, who said that he was sending another company up to relieve me on my position overlooking the Simito, and that I was to take my company across with 60 and I across the river and to reorganize with them across the other side. And I was concerned with having heard the reports that the 8th DLI had found the water between 3 and 6 foot deep. And we were going to carry these very heavy loads. I was concerned about whether we were going to lose soldiers through drowning, as some of the 8th DLI had been drowned. But fortunately, on our trucks, we had got the Mae West life jackets, which we had had to come ashore on the beaches of Avola. And so we got them off the trucks and got everybody equipped with the Mae West. And we also made a rope of signal cable, twisted signal cable. And so after darkness fell, about midnight, offset the DLI, 6th DLI, down a route, the same one which Alistair Pearson had taken the night before. And we followed as fast as we could behind the reserve company of 6th DLI, carrying our machine guns and 12 bolts of ammunition per gun. We got down to the river, and we got one or two people across with one end of our wire rope, and then everybody else waded across. It came up to the necks of the small chaps and up to the shoulders of the larger chaps, and we managed to get practically everybody across, but when we had practically finished, a figure suddenly appeared out of the rushes on the other side of the river and shot one of our chaps dead. We never discovered who he was, whether he was an enemy or one of our own troops or what, but it was getting very uncomfortable towards the as the last of our people got across, because the enemy by this time had got a fixed line on the river and were firing on it with machine guns. But except that one casualty, we got across. And I made my way along until I found the CEO of the 6DLI, Colonel Watson. Then I said to him, right, sir, here we are. What do you want us to do? And he said, good God, that's magnificent. No, he hadn't expected you for another 3 hours. He said, I haven't the faintest idea where my companies are. So I think all we can do is just lie quiet here on the riverbank until first light, and then I will try in the meantime to see what's happening. He said, I have sent to both the forward companies to send guides back to guide your platoons up into their positions, but no guides have so far turned up, and I have no idea where the companies are. So we spent a very miserable night, absolutely soaked through, lying on this riverbank or just inside of it in the vineyards, with a fair amount of bullets sweeping the vineyards in front of us, and not having any idea of where our own people were. In fact, I think some of the leading companies of the 6DLI and then of the 9DLI who'd come through after them had been making progress, but were having a fairly sticky time. And in fact, as soon as it was beginning to get light, I went off with the second in command of the six Durhams and with one of my platoon commanders to try and make contact with the forward companies. And we'd only gone a very short distance before we were pinned down by fire from this sunken ditch. And we lay there unable to move until suddenly a Sherman tank appeared in the vineyard in which we lay, having come across the river and found that the vineyards and the vines were no obstacle at all to tanks. And before long there were five tanks there, and the situation began to ease very considerably. The Durhams made contact with each other, and we went forward from the riverbank up to the sunken road and got into position forward of the sunken road some mile from the river bank. I had just got both my platoons in position astride the road leading down from Catania to the bridge behind us now, the Primosoli Bridge, when my second command came forward with the transport. And I went around then to have a look at the sunken road. And it was, I think it was became known as Stink Alley. There were bodies everywhere. The German paratroops had put up a tremendous resistance. And then, of course, the bodies of the Durhams everywhere, too. And it was, I think, the bloodiest battle which I'd ever been in. And as bad, if not worse, certainly, than the Marath battle. While we were just settling in, a couple of stretcher bearers from one of the DLI battalions came running across to me and said, sir, have you got a pistol? So I said, yes. And they said, well, come with us quickly. And they took me across to the regimental aid post of this particular battalion. And there was a German paratrooper lying on a stretcher. And one of them said, shoot him, shoot him. And I said, what for? And he said, well, that bugger, just as we were lifting him onto the stretcher, he suddenly pulled out a grenade and threw it at some of our chaps, and he's killed some. And I got my pistol out, but I said, sorry, I can't kill anybody in cold blood like that. So I said, you would probably have done the same, wouldn't you, if you'd been captured? You would have done anything you could to cause damage, even if you were wounded. And they said, well, suppose you're right. And the last I saw them, they were mollycoddling and mothering this chap. But it presented an interesting little moral question at the time, what one should do. We were just looking forward to a slight rest, as much of rest as one could do while digging in furiously with the enemy. We weren't quite sure how far away. It was reasonably quiet now, the battle over, when up came my commanding officer, Colonel Keeling, again. And he said, right, I'm sending another company to relieve you here. I want you out of position as soon as possible to support an attack by 168 Brigade tonight. And 168 Brigade was an extra brigade which had been given to 50 Div to make up for the brigade we had lost in the desert at Gazala. So that for this operation we had, Sicily operation, we had 69 Brigade and 151 Brigade, our original battalion brigades, and this unnamed brigade, 168, which we had never seen up this time, and which had never been in battle, and it had been doing a little bit of mopping up behind our two brigades as we went forward, but otherwise than that had never had a shot fired. And they had been given the job of advancing on the right of the road towards Catania up to a ditch called the Fosse Botticetto, which ran across the plain, the main road in front of us, and just almost on the edge of Catania Aerodrome. The task the commanding officer wanted me to do was to fire on a wood which was about 500 yards to the east of the main road and about a mile in front of the Primacelli Bridge, where it was thought that the enemy survivors from the bridge might have gone. And my job was to fire on the line of the wood, on the edge of the wood, to prevent any interference from the one against 168 Brigade as they walked forward to secure the Fosse Battery in Botticetto. It wasn't known whether the ditch itself, the fosse, was occupied or not, or just how many troops there might be in this wood. Patrols sent out by various people reported that there didn't appear to be any enemy in the ditch or in the area at all. In these days we weren't very good at air reconnaissance or air photographs. In Normandy days, and where we became so used to operating off air photographs with map grids drawn on them, so that you knew exactly the country you were going to meet up with and probably the enemy positions which were holding them. But here we didn't have any air reconnaissance, so no one knew exactly what lay ahead. Anyhow, I took my weary troops off and found battle positions for them to fire in support of 168 Brigade. And it was an area known as the Tower on the east of the Primacelli Bridge. We got in, did our reconnaissance in daylight, laid out our gun lines in approved artillery fashion, and then we and got into position as soon as it was dark. And at 11 o'clock that night, I think it was, we opened up on the wood in the front. And 20 minutes later, we were ordered to cease firing because it had been decided that it should be a silent attack instead of, because the enemy probably weren't there anyhow. And we were absolutely exhausted by this time. We had been in action non-stop since we arrived on the 10th of July. We'd had this night crossing of the Sumito River the night before, without any sleep. And we hoped at this stage that, having been told cease firing, that we would get some sleep. But at 3 o'clock in the morning, the second commander of my company, Captain Abel, who in peacetime was a shipping magnate, arrived up to say there was a big parachute scare on, a German parachute being landed behind, and everybody got to stand too. And so we stood to for the rest of the night, and no sleep. Just before light, the Colonel Keeling arrived up to take me along for another reconnaissance. He said that the 168 Brigade attack had failed. They had failed to capture their own start line, and they had run into a much more severe opposition than was expected, and being absolutely brand new and having lost their way in the dark and so on, although some of the battalions had done quite well, nobody knew they'd done quite well, and so in the end 168 Brigade were pulled back, and that attack was abandoned. And it was decided at this stage that the division would simply hold the line of the Sumito while Monty conducted operations on the other flank and up through the centre. And the actual bid to the Lightning thrust up through Catania was no more. And so we, my three platoons, were put in position on the east of the Primosoli Bridge, and there we stayed for a fortnight. This was one of the occasions when the battalion commander was able to produce a coordinated battalion fire plan, and we had our various fixed lines which were all registered. Wherever possible, we used to actually fire these tasks and get the infantry to report whether the bullets were landing where they wanted them to, or whether they wanted them closer to themselves or further away. Exactly like the gunners did, but with a low trajectory weapon instead of a high trajectory weapon.